Hi, I'm Paul Harris, Dan Strauss, Ian Geis, and Colin Jeffrey here now for the showbiz segment of the show. Hi, Colin. How are you?
Doing well. How are you today, Paul?
I'm doing just fine. We have a couple of movies to get to and a bunch of online stuff. But before we get to any of that, I got an email from a loyal listener by the name of Linda, who said, next time you and Colin have your showbiz segment, I wonder if you could talk about this because you've actually been in a movie. She says, whoa. For instance, what do directors and assistant directors and producers and co-producers actually do when they're making a movie? Who's usually involved in the decisions regarding casting, editing, and so on? The director, the writer, the producer? Are there several producers involved? Do they choose the director? And also she says, I always see a bunch of people in the writing credits, so I wonder how much input a book author has in converting their book to film. And what exactly is a screenwriter? Is that the person who rewrites the book and creates new dialogue and chooses what ends up in the movie? And she says, finally, I'm particularly curious as to why there can be multiple producers, co-producers, and so many production companies listed at the end of a movie. I always see the terms in partnership. What does that mean? Can you explain these things, Linda in Brentwood?
That is a lot of questions right there.
That is a lot of questions.
And let's start with the screenwriting, because I heard that. And okay. So when you're talking specifically about an author, how much input they have,
yeah,
it varies. E.L. James, the writer of 50 Shades of Grey, was famously very upset with the script of the movie. She was not happy with it because they took her book. They, I'm certain, asked for input at points, but then the writers and producers took and director took over and said, we're going to take it this direction because it works better.
Mm-hmm.
She's I'm not going to say she's a very good writer because I think they did one of these read throughs and, you know, they scanned it. It's written at like a fourth grade level. It's not literature.
Mm-hmm.
But she was upset. J.K. Rowling, on the other hand, with Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, was very involved with the screenwriting process. And so this lived much closer to her vision of what was going to happen there. And why there are so many writers is when we hear that there's a rewrite of a movie or they're having to go back and reshoot things, that doesn't mean necessarily that it's in trouble, because these writers aren't all sitting in a room together and brainstorming this. Someone's writing it, and mm-hmm. they might be have a writing partner, and they're working on it. And then there's other writers that are going through and tightening up dialogue, and then they will give this script over to someone else to look at, and that's when they say, oh, we need to rewrite these sections. It's not a bunch of people sitting around in a room hashing out every word.
Right. Just to give you an example, Tootsie is one of the most famous movies for having the most writers on it. It had 11 people involved in writing that movie. And part of that is because you have the original idea, and then you have the director come on board, and he wants to make some changes, and so he's added on there. And then Dustin Hoffman comes on board, and he wants some changes. He wants somebody else to do it, and then that doesn't quite work, and so these other two people come on. And there's also something in Hollywood called a script doctor. Carrie Fisher was one of the most famous script doctors in Hollywood, which means they would hire her to come in and fix this scene. It just doesn't work. Or
punch it up. Don't they punch up a script?
Yeah, absolutely. Add some jokes here and there. So that is all there. If you just see screenwriter and it's not based on another book, well, that, you know, at the Academy Awards, they have adapted screenplay and original screenplay. If it's original screenplay and it's one person, then that person thought up the idea for that movie and turned it into what you see on the screen, at least writing it. Mm-hmm. Now, many, many times, the screenwriter finishes their script, hands it in, the director takes over, and he or she does with it what they want, and the screenwriter's not even coming to the set. They're done. Once they finish writing the movie, they're done. And I've also talked to book authors who, once they sold their book to a producer or a studio or whoever it is, they're done with that. I remember the movie Sideways?
Yes.
With Paul Giamatti and Thomas Hayden Church.
Yeah.
They went into the wine country of the Napa Valley, and it's an adventure that the two of them have there. I talked to the guy who was the author of the book the movie was based on, and I talked to him because it was the week of the Academy Awards, and he was not invited with the rest of the movie people. He was invited to go sit up in like the third mezzanine of the theater there, and he didn't even get a guest ticket. It was like, okay, you can come. Here's one ticket for you. He told me that when he wrote the book, they bought the book, and he never heard from them again.
There you go.
They never came to him and said, we want to change this, we want to change that. So they it could be any level of that, depending on who it is.
Yeah.
Even Stephen King quite often just sells him the book and fine, I'm going to write another book. You guys make your movie.
And that's why he does all those made-for-TV specials, because he's like, I'm not happy with it, so I'm going to go do my own version of this. Most notably, The Shining. He didn't like Kubrick's The Shining, which is incomprehensible to me because it's one of the greatest movies ever made, but he didn't like it. So then he made a very, 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 very bad TV miniseries movie that was just atrocious. Producers, this is interesting to talk about. First of all, if you've not seen the 1997 movie Wag the Dog, a Barry Levinson movie, you should see this. The story is about the president has a sex scandal, so they create a war by going and hiring a Hollywood producer. That's Dustin Hoffman playing the character of Stanley Motz.
Which is really based on Bob Evans, who was a big-time Hollywood producer and ran Paramount Pictures for a long time.
And in the movie, here's the reason I'm bringing it up. In the movie, they're asking, someone asks, what does a producer do? And he says, we do everything. And that is, they literally do everything. Their job can begin with buying the book or script.
Yep.
Then they can hire a director, be involved in casting, be there on the set, making certain things are running. They can do everything. Or they can just say, here's $250,000.
Right, they write the check.
Here's $500,000.
Or in many cases, a producer goes out and gets the money from other people.
Yeah.
Because the famous line in Hollywood is, never make a movie with your own money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they go and raise money. And now, sometimes producer credits are handed out to, you know, like if you watch Batman vs. Superman, I think Ben Affleck may be a producer on there. Mm-hmm. I doubt he tossed in any of his own money, but they're saying, hey, you're going to be a part of this. You can get a producer credit.
And as a producer, he gets a piece of the action.
He gets money.
Right.
So producers do a lot. They work quite often. They can do a lot, but they'll work with a casting director that they know.
By the way, there's also executive producers, and those are really the people who are at the top of that pyramid who are involved in getting all those other people. Under that, you got producers and assistant producers and co-producers, and that could be, you know, the leading man's girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gets a credit.
Oh, yeah.
It could be anything.
Well, yeah. I mean, what was it famously in Star Wars? The gopher, the guy who runs and gets all the stuff for, he got a chunk of the movie.
Yeah.
He didn't make it until they gave him a piece of it. So, I don't know. There's a lot. Directors.
Director, I will tell you, that's the person who's in charge of everything creative on the movie. They take the story and their script. Maybe they've written the script. Maybe they've rewritten the script. Maybe they're taking it the way it was actually written from the beginning. You know, if you're directing a script written by David Mamet, you're probably not changing any of the words.
No.
So you then have to take what that is and turn it into the visual movie that people are going to see. You're going to hire the people. You're going to probably talk to your casting director, who's the one who actually sits down and auditions the various people who are going to be in there. But the director makes the decision on who's going to be in the movie, what tone the movie's going to have, working with the cinematographer, who's the director of photography, on how the look of the movie will come across on screen. Are we going to cut here, working with the editor to determine what the final version of the movie is going to look like after all the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of takes that they've done. I heard Tom Hanks once described when he directed That Thing You Do, which is a wonderful movie if you've never seen it. He was asked, what does the director do? He says, you answer stupid questions all day long. And I'm not putting down the people who are asking them, but they're stupid questions like, how tall do you want that plant to be? The sort of thing you would never think of. Like, that's a stupid question. But then you realize, oh, well, I have to decide that because I'm the director.
Yeah.
That's why they gave me a chair with my name on it.
And there's different types. There's a theory out there called the Artur theory, which essentially says that the director is the artist of the movie, the author of the movie. And this means that their personal stamp is on every single line. The Coen brothers have editors that they work with, and they trust them. And so they say, go edit this down. I mean, they work, I can't remember the name of the editor they work with most frequently, but they have an editor they work with and place an enormous amount of trust on them to say, we've given you the raw materials, start to give us a cut of the movie.
Yep.
Directors like Quentin Tarantino, Wes Anderson, Francois Truffaut,
Martin Scorsese, Hitchcock,
David O. Russell. These are more of the auteur directors where they're involved in, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
In the writing, from
choosing the score.
Yeah.
Choosing what songs they're going to use, choosing the lighting, choosing all of that stuff. Yeah. That's what the director
does. One of my, from A to Z, as the British would say. I love that. And we don't say that over here.
And then the other job that you asked about, Linda, is assistant director. And this is the one that I have the closest knowledge of. And Dan, you probably do too, because we were extras in a movie, and this is where mm-hmm. you actually get to deal with the assistant director. He or she is the one with the walkie-talkie who has to round up the extras
yep.
to get them to stand in a certain place or sit there, or, you know, it's the stand-in is sitting there while they're lighting a scene, and now they have to go get the star of the movie, so the assistant director will go knock on that person's door or their trailer door or whatever it is and try to get them to come to the set, and, you know, now we're going to shoot that scene. And there are first assistant directors and second assistant directors and on and on and on.
And location directors, if they're shooting in multiple places, they yes. won't fly. Yeah, it's crazy.
There are hundreds of jobs, but those are the primary ones, Linda, and I hope that gives you a better idea of what they do. The last thing you asked about was why we see so many production companies listed. Mm-hmm. And this is what's become really annoying to me, particularly in the last 10 years. If you go see a movie now, before the movie starts, you see the logos, animated and musical logos for every production company that's involved in that. And sometimes it's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of those in a row.
New Line Cinema, MGM, and the Weinstein Company present.
No, but it's also companies
Screen
you've never
Gems.
Heard of.
Oh, no, yeah. that's it keeps yeah. going.
We Love Carpets. That's the name of one production company, or, you know.
Focus Features, in association with Castle Rock and Legendary Entertainment, present a Pixar and DreamWorks collaboration.
Exactly.
Brought to you by Marvel and Summit Entertainment. Yeah,
okay, so you want to know who those people are? That's money. Those yeah. are the people who have put money into this project. Either they put it in from the beginning, or the movie was made and went around to some of the film festivals like Sundance and other places, and they showed it, and then somebody bought it. For instance, the movie that I was in, am I still allowed to mention it this
oh,
year?
Sure, yeah.
Mississippi yeah. Grind. It was yeah. made by this couple, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. They made the movie. They took it to Sundance, and it was bought by a distribution company called A24. So naturally, at the beginning of that movie, it says A24 presents. But they also got sub money to go behind that. And so all of that, all of those people are in there. And everybody there gets in the producers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
All of those production companies that you're referring to, Linda, that's all money. Just think, those people put money into this. Those people put money into it. And they went out and got other people to put money into it.
My favorite is when the filmmakers have their own. Like Bad Robot is J.J. Abrams.
Yes.
40 Acres and a Mule, Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Happy Madison is Adam Sandler. Yeah, yeah, it's just, they all have their own.
I was in Up in the Air with yeah. George Clooney.
Yes.
I have no clue at what the anything says on the credits. I just went to my part and looked for it.
You never saw Up in the Air in a movie theater?
No, I did.
Oh.
Yeah, we did. We did.
But now you know exactly how far in it is
yes.
to get to your piece.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm the same one, same way with Mississippi Grind. So I hope that answers your question, Linda. I'm glad you asked that because a lot of people don't know that sort of stuff, and I'm glad we could go over it. Now let's get to the movies for this week, and you're starting us off with The Space Between Us.
An adapted screenplay.
Okay.
The Space Between Us is based off, I'm going to call it a young adult novel, in which humans have gone to Mars, and the first people who are sent to Mars, the first crew, on their way to Mars, they discover that the lead astronaut is pregnant, and they can't turn the ship around, so they make the decision to allow her to go to Mars, deliver the baby. But the problem is she dies during childbirth. So now they've got this little boy on Mars. And as you can expect, this company wants to make certain that everything is broadcast because it's expensive. So they want to make money. They decide to keep the boy a secret. And he grows up on Mars.
Okay.
Is this a true story?
Based
on a true story.
Yeah. He's actually the second Martian because Matt Damon, of course, was
the first. Exactly. Oh. So that's the rough outline of how we get to the movie. The bummer part of this is I think it takes about 20 minutes to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about a 2-hour movie, 20 minutes to just set up what we care about. It's like, I don't have enough time in 20 minutes to get attached to the mom.
So is the movie all about this boy growing up on Mars?
Well, we flash forward then 16 years, and Gary Oldman, who is in charge of the company, it's like the Genesis project that worked with NASA to send people, helped make this decision to keep the boy a secret. 16 years later, he has grown up and has only ever been on Mars, mm-hmm. obviously. But they decide as a company, BD Wong is in this, who's a corporate stooge. They decide, we have to tell people about this. We're going to bring him back and see how he's doing. And then we may tell people he was born on Mars. The problem is Mars has much lower gravity than Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So all of his bones and organs have formed in only lower gravity. And will he survive the trip back? Well, unbeknownst to them, he's been communicating with a girl on Earth, who's a high school girl,
yeah.
his age. And he's fallen in love with her through their, you know, video chats or text message exchanges.
Okay, I have to just stop you right there. In the movie, does it show them chatting in real time?
Oh, that is the worst part. There's a scene at which, yes, they're chatting and interacting.
Okay, impossible.
It's 15 minutes, I think, is how 20, long.
Yeah. 20 minutes.
But then they get away with it by just putting in the upper light hand or upper left hand corner of like the screen where they're video chatting instantly, like quantum light compression. And it's just
Now, cannot happen.
No, this movie is not at all based in science. Other than we're supposed to believe this thing about, oh, yeah, his bones would be brittle and he would break. And so they have to put, like, he's got to go some horribly invasive surgery.
Yeah, he learned to talk. Is there like a...
There are other people on Mars. Okay. There's a lot of people. There's a permanent settlement on Mars.
Okay. Remember Miles O'Brien, who used to be the science correspondent for CNN for many, many years? He left there a few years ago. I think CNN cut out the science unit, so he was gone. But I remember hearing an interview with him in which he was asked, would you like to go to Mars? He said, absolutely. As a science correspondent, that would be the greatest thrill of my lifetime. And then he was asked, would you like to do live reports from Mars? He said, I'd like to, but it would be impossible because it's so far away. The signal would take 20 minutes to get there, and then you would respond to whatever I said, ask me another question, and it's another 20 minutes to go the other way. So I would be answering you every 40 minutes. It would not be live. And so that's why I ask about the live video chat in this.
Yeah.
They just forget about that. Science doesn't matter.
Yes. Hello, 911.
Oh. When the
if you're on Mars and you have a 911, don't be calling Earth.
When the young man returns to Earth, though, mm-hmm. he decides, I'm not going to be tested. I'm tired of this. I'm going to go meet this girl that he calls Tulsa because, I don't know, she grew up in Tulsa or something, but now she's in Colorado.
You know
so
what Tulsa spelled backwards is?
Yes, Dan.
Okay.
Why don't you tell us all what the 16-year-old girl's name is spelled backwards?
Okay.
No, I'll just let everybody else do it.
Okay.
Dick Dastardly and his dog.
Yeah, that's right.
So he decides he's going to run away, and of course manages to outsmart the collective intelligence of all of the government wanting to keep him a secret.
Yeah, they only have him quarantined. But he's able to get out of quarantine, no problem.
Sure. So he goes and sees her and says, hey, I want to go meet my dad. Here's this picture I have that I hacked off of the computer on Mars, and I want to go meet this guy. He won't know that I was born ever, but I'm 16, so of course he'll recognize me. And he sets out across country with this girl that he's fallen in love with from afar. And of course, they go on the trip, and she's very curious about him and disbelieving that he was ever born on Mars, that he was born on Mars. And then it just, you know, it's the typical what you expect. They, of course, fall in love because they're going together, but mm-hmm. he'll die if he stays on Earth. So what's going to happen? There are so many problems with this movie. Aside from the fact that they got Britt Robertson, a 26-year-old, to play a 16-year-old girl. Second of all, I, as a father of a young 5-year-old girl, do not ever want to see on screen 16-year-old kids having implied sex.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good if you just don't show me that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of weird to look at on a screen.
Okay.
Just in general. The whole movie's uncomfortable. It's not really believable. It's not that they don't have chemistry. It's just that it's stupid. It's just a dumb premise. It's just a really dumb premise that this kid comes all the way back from Mars, and it's because he's a teenage boy controlled by hormones, and is still able to outsmart the government at every turn. And
yeah,
no, just it was just it's bad. And you know, I guess if you read the book and you really want to see it, you're going to go see it. There's nothing I can do, but
you're not recommending it. What do you give it on a scale of 10?
No, 2.
Wow.
I give a point to each. Gary Oldman, because he's good just all the time. I'd watch him act. And Britt Robertson is charming, but she's 26. And we have to stop casting 26-year-olds to play 16-year-olds and then putting them in sexualized situations. Mm. It's just, yeah, it's frustrating.
What's it rated?
PG-13. Oh, because it's all implied. They have they go camping out and they link their two sleeping bags together. Uh-huh. And so then we can see disrobed shoulders. And of course,
and then the camera pans away from the tent and up to the sky. Oh. Is it one of those things?
No, they're sleeping under the stars because it's a whole new sky to him because he was on Mars. And it's just
a whole new sky.
It's dumb. It's a foolish movie.
Worst song in The Lion King, A Whole New Sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. So two out of ten for A Space Between Us. When we come back, I have the new Robert De Niro movie called The Comedian. I'll review that for you. We'll have more showbiz stuff coming up as well here on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the showbiz segment of the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon here on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris, Dan Strauss, Ian Geis, and Colin Jeffrey all here with me. If you missed the last segment, Colin gave 2 out of 10 to The Space Between Us, the story of a boy born on Mars who comes back to Earth and falls in love.
Based on a true story.
Yeah. Yep. And it actually made Colin say, this was stupid. And anytime a movie reviewer says that, you know, they're just frustrated and they can't take it anymore. Now, the other movie that I want to, you know, let me just mention that there are two other movies that are opening this weekend. One is Rings, which is, I believe, the second sequel to a movie that became a pretty big viral hit. Yeah. 10 or 15 years ago called The Ring, which was about everybody who watches a VHS tape ends up dead.
Yes.
I don't know what they're watching in the new 2017 version of this, but I'm guessing it's not a VHS tape.
No, I don't know that you could find a VHS player.
I don't know.
Like, I don't know where you'd...
I do know that Johnny Galecki is the star of this movie, and I would think that all of his years on The Big Bang Theory... where he gets paid something like $1 million an episode, and it's a show that's been on the air 10 years, you would think that that would get him a chance to make movies that would have big paydays. Can Rings be writing him a big check, do you think?
I would hope not.
Well, it opens this weekend.
We were talking about this. This has 5 credited writers, and it's based off the Japanese movie, Ringu, I think is what it was called. And so it's got, like, you'll see, if you go see this, it has 6 credited writers. And I can only imagine, I think they might have just been throwing things at the keyboard or something. I talked to a few people who saw it, and they didn't say
Ringu.
Complimentary.
Yeah, Beatles.
He was my favorite of the Japanese Beatles. Thank you. Then there's also I Am Not Your Negro, which is a documentary about the writer James Baldwin. You've seen it?
Yeah.
Okay. Nominated for Best Documentary at the Oscars.
Yes.
I have not seen it. And then there's The Comedian, starring Robert De Niro. Now, there are no comedies that are out in movie theaters right now. There are no funny movies that you can go see. Mm-mm. I'm including in that The Comedian. Give you an idea where my review of this is going to go. Back about 20-plus years ago, Robert De Niro starred in a movie called The King of Comedy, a Martin Scorsese movie in which he plays a guy named Rupert Pupkin, who is a guy who wants to be in show business and loves a character named Jerry Langford, who was played by Jerry Lewis, who was kind of like a Johnny Carson kind of late-night host. And Rupert Pupkin is a huge fan of his, and so is a character named Masha, who was played by Sandra Bernhard. Remember when she was around for a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
And they stalk and kidnap the Jerry Lewis character in an attempt to make Rupert Pupkin famous, which does happen towards the end of the movie. I don't say spoiler alert on movies that are over 20 years old. This movie, The Comedian, should have been called Rupert Pupkin Gets Old. Because in The King of Comedy, De Niro, as Rupert Pupkin, is a guy who thinks he's funny and has considerable material, but his delivery is so hack and so stilted, it just doesn't work. And now here's Robert De Niro playing an older comedian who's still trying to get his career back on track after some things have gone wrong. And it just doesn't work. The character's name is Jackie Burke. He's a comedian who's been around for a long time. 30 years ago, he was on a hit TV show playing a character named Eddie, who had some sort of catchphrase that I can't remember, and it doesn't matter. But to give you an idea what level he's at, he isn't playing the Fox Theater. He isn't even playing the Funny Bone. He's playing, like, low-level, tiniest-level stand-up comedy clubs, and he's working with other TV has-beens like Jimmy Walker and Brett Butler. Those are the people who were there at the club. Edie Falco plays his manager. Her father had been his manager for many years, and now her father is dead, and so she's taken over the business, and she's managing the De Niro character, Jackie Burke, and his career's not going well, so she's the long-suffering woman who just goes along, come on, Jackie, I'm doing my best, I'm just trying, I should fire you and get a real agent. Come on, Jackie, I'm really trying, you know, there's not that many, it's that kind of thing. So at this comedy club where he's appearing with Jimmy Walker and Brett Butler, there's a guy in the audience who's heckling him, who is egging him on. And the guy's wife or girlfriend has a video camera, and it's obvious that they're doing this to get some YouTube footage. And it turns out that they have their own online show in which they go in their provocateurs in comedy clubs, and they want to see what the comic does and how they handle it. And in this case, the De Niro character, Jackie Burke, punches the guy and knocks him down and breaks his nose. The cops get called. He gets arrested. It goes to court. In court, he insults the guy some more. The judge says, I was going to give you just probation and make you do some community service, but first you're going to do 30 days in the slammer, which he does.
It's a great setup for a comedy.
Yes. He comes out, and he still has to do the community service. So he ends up working at a homeless shelter, serving food to homeless guys, and another person who works there is a woman named Harmony. Not E-Harmony, just Harmony. And she's played by Leslie Mann.
Okay.
The only reason you know Leslie Mann is because she's in every Judd Apatow movie because she's Judd Apatow's wife.
Yes.
And in this, she plays the same giggly Leslie Mann character she does in the other movies. And naturally, they fall for each other. Don't let the 30-year age difference come into your mind at all while you see De Niro and Leslie Mann. He falls for her. But her father, played by Harvey Keitel, doesn't like it and tries to break them up and get her to come live with him in Florida where he runs some old age homes. Does this sound convoluted for a comedy? It is. Mm-hmm. But wait, there's more.
Okay.
Because De Niro is now down on his luck. He got out of jail. He didn't have any money. So he goes see his brother, played by Danny DeVito, who runs a deli. Oh, did I mention that these are both old Jews? Because when I think of old Jews, I think De Niro and DeVito.
Yeah.
Not that they're not good actors who can't play anybody, but they're completely miscast in these roles. Patti LuPone is in the movie, too. She plays Danny DeVito's wife. The entire reason for her to be there is to be a nag and complain about De Niro's character. Not flattering for her at all. There's also a scene at the Friars Club with Charles Grodin, as a comic who years ago stole some bits from Jackie, but now he's the dean of all the comedians there, and they're doing a TV special to honor a character played by Cloris Leachman, who's 95 years old, and Edie Falco wants Robert De Niro's character to get on that, and so he has to suck up to the Charles Grodin character. Oh, my God! I've had it just describing this to you. None of this works.
Who would name their kid Cloris? Way too close.
None of this works at all. And one of the reasons is it is so hard to make movies about stand-up comedians. Even stand-up comedians like Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen couldn't do it when they made Judd Apatow's Funny People. But then you have non-comedians. Do you remember Tom Hanks in Punchline with Sally Field?
Yeah.
Terrible. To my knowledge, the only good movie that's ever been made about stand-up comedy is a documentary that Jerry Seinfeld made in 2002 called Comedian. Do not confuse Comedian with The Comedian, mm-hmm. which is the De Niro movie that's out now. Even Billy Crystal couldn't do a good job with Mr. Saturday mm-hmm. Night. I like that movie, but it's not like he's a great stand-up comic in that. It just doesn't work. And by the way, it's also 2 hours long, which is way too long for any comedy. Although it is shorter than every Judd Apatow movie ever made. They're always 2.5 hours for no reason. So you got De Niro's character, who's not funny. You got real comedians who appear in this movie, some of whom worked on the script, like Jeffrey Ross, who I like a lot, and Jim Norton, Hannibal Buress, Gilbert Gottfried, Nick DiPaolo. They're all in there. They could not save a movie that was not funny because you cast Robert De Niro as an old Jewish comedian and thought that that would work. It doesn't. This was directed by Taylor Hackford, who knows how to make showbiz movies. After all, he did Ray. Mm-hmm. The Ray Charles movie. He also did the Chuck Berry documentary, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, filmed at the Fox Theater right here in St. Louis back in 1996. He did An Officer and a Gentleman and White Knights and The Devil's Advocate. He's married to Helen Mirren. The guy knows something about movies. What he doesn't know is comedy.
Yeah.
None of those things I just mentioned are comedies, and neither is the comedian.
Is this like rude and crude also?
Yes, yes. More F-bombs than needed. You know, I don't mind that kind of language, yeah, but it's unnecessarily dropped in this movie. As with any hack comedian, they say the F-word to try to make the joke funnier.
Yeah, to get a laugh.
And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. 4 out of 10 for me, for the comedian. Now, with these two movies that we've just talked about here, it does raise the question, and I mentioned this to my wife the other night, because I'm looking at the movies that are coming up for the rest of this month, and there's nothing I really want to go see. And we, you and I, have mentioned over the last couple of years how bad August and February are for movies. Mm-hmm. Explain why February is usually such a wasteland for movies.
Well, because all the good movies have pushed out in time for awards season. They released in the coast, essentially, in December to make certain they could be nominated. And then they rolled out through the rest of the country in January.
Mm-hmm.
Those have run their course now, and those awards movies typically aren't big earners. You don't have a huge amount, but the studios have just spent all their money promoting these and getting them out and mm-hmm. all that. Now we've got all these movies that they know will get crushed in the summer. They're not going to be awards contenders, so they're not going to come out in the fall.
Yep.
And so they try and put them out when there's less competition to make some money. Because it's cold and movie theaters are warm.
Yeah.
Not really. I don't know the thought there. Every movie theater is freezing. But what's odd is next week there are 3 legitimate, pretty large releases. The second John Wick movie comes out, Lego Batman comes out, and 50 Shades Darker that will be garbage, but it doesn't matter. Because all of our moms will go see this, or wives in these cases, will go see this because they love those movies. The last one made more than $500 million.
Wow. Like,
so they've got 3 movies that are all could make pretty good money. Granted, they all target different audiences, so maybe that's why they're coming out on the same week. But next weekend could be really big. This weekend, I don't see any reason that Split and Hidden Figures won't continue to have good runs.
Yep.
Because Rings is coming out. Yeah, nothing real big.
Nothing's going to make a huge box office splash.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. So go see some of those, or go see some of the ones that you haven't seen that are nominated for Academy Awards, like Lion.
La La Land is making a wider release. I think Moana might be back in theaters with a sing-along version at some point here, so if you haven't taken your kids to see that.
Hacksaw Ridge.
Go see that.
See that if you want to see a war movie.
There's something else I noticed in news. Avatar 2 is going to start filming because he's now written the scripts for 2, 3, 4, and 5, so he's ready to start filming, too.
Holy moly.
Wow. Yep.
Now, that's based on a true story.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I figured.
All right, that's all the time we have for the showbiz stuff this week. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you.
We'll be back with the Harris Challenge and Knuckleheads in the News and Mike Evans in the 5 o'clock hour, all here on the Big 550 KTRS.